So if you look at a CA3 neuron, it's a pyramidal cell and has an apical dendrite that extends out in this direction. And it receives three kinds of excitatory inputs. It receives in its proximal region inputs from the dentate, which is the main input, main input from another region. And these form a very characteristic kind of synapse called the Mossy fiber synapse that's shown on cartoon form on the right. These synapses are morphologically very distinct, and I'll show you a few examples of these. They form very large synapses that have multiple spine heads off of one neck, and the presynaptic bouton is correspondingly very complicated, and the synapse is highly facilitating. Further out in the dendrite, the cell receives input from other CA3 neurons via association fibers. And so the cell receives lots and lots of CA3 inputs, and these synapses tend to be more classical synapses. There's usually one presynaptic bouton in apposition with one postsynaptic spine. And further out, there are inputs from entorhinal cortex that directly innervate the distal part of the dendrite. So there are multiple kinds of excitatory inputs onto these cells, and I haven't shown you the inhibitor inputs, which are also quite diverse. And so we'd like to understand something about how inputs onto the cell are specified. And I'm going to tell you about a couple of things today. So the first part will have to do with just looking at the development of one of these synapses. And most of the talk is focused on this synapse, the dentate CA3 synapse, maybe the first two-thirds of the talk. And then in the last part, I'll talk about some general properties of synapses and how they develop. So in the beginning, I'll tell you a little bit about how this synapse develops morphologically, and then tell you about our efforts to understand what the molecular mechanisms are that regulate the formation of this synapse. And in the last third of the talk, I'll talk about the molecules that we think are involved in conferring functional properties to synapses, so the kinds of signals that regulate pre- and postsynaptic differentiation. Now, I think the circuit runs in fairly similar ways in the cortex and hippocampus. There really aren't big fundamental differences in the kinds of interneurons you find in the hippocampus versus the cortex. So my talks don't have to do with gain control, so I don't know why hippocampal people don't talk about gain control. But definitely all the cell types are still there. And their general connectivity in terms of feed-forward and feedback inhibition is similarly organized to the cortex. So yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so you can take the cortical circuitry, although they'll have sometimes different names, because initially when the anatomist characterized the hippocampal interneurons, they might call a neuron a different name than a similar cell in the cortex. But in terms of its position in the circuit and where it innervates, it's very similar. Okay. Now, one of the reasons we were interested in this was that how cortical circuits or hippocampal circuits develop is not very well understood, and there has often been a big emphasis on activity. So when I was a graduate student, the way people would describe the development of circuitry kind of went along these lines, that you have axons that grow into some region, they make lots of synapses with whatever targets are available to them, and then there is some experience-dependent or activity-dependent process that allows all the bad synapses to go, and you're left with the correct set of synapses. And this was never really based on, in my mind, very strong evidence. And we can discuss what the evidence was for it if you'd like. But there was a sense that you have kind of lots of random connections, and from that you can get specificity of functional connections. And the reason I think the evidence was not very good is that it's very difficult actually to determine precisely the connectivity of cells in the cortex or any very complex tissue in the CNS, and that's still the case today. So even in the adult cortex, the connectivity is not fully mapped, maybe Clay talked a little bit about this in his talk, and then you go to development, it's probably even more complicated because the identities of cells can be harder to assign. And So part of the question was that, well, is there specificity, and how much of the specificity resides in individual cells? Can an individual neuron find its target independent of activity or experience and the spatial cues that might be present in the brain? And the other part was to gain some understanding of how a particular class of synapse develops. And this is often hard in the cortex, because if you cannot tell where your synapses are coming from, even if you have nice tools, it can be difficult to kind of follow the development of that particular synapse. In this case, this is a very nice synapse to study, because the way the projections are organized are such that you can uniquely identify these dentate axons coming into CA3. You can look at their morphology. You can ask what happens as the synapse develops. So in order to study, I don't know if these lights can be dimmed. For a couple of them, you might need them. OK, so so in order to look at synaptic connectivity, we decided to use this method called serial block phase scanning EM, which I will briefly introduce. Some of you might have heard about it. It's a method developed by Winfried Denk and his colleagues. And it really hasn't been used extensively to address specific questions. It's been in the technology development phase for a long time. The EM part of this is a collaboration with Mark Ellisman's lab at UCSD. And they have one of these machines. And we've been hearing about the fact that you could use this to reconstruct some volumes of tissue. And we wanted to know whether or not we could apply this to learn something about how this synapse develops. And part of the reason for applying it here is that that particular synapse that I talked about, the MOSI fiber synapse, is a very large and complex synapse. And so even by standard transmission EM methods, it's actually hard to fully see the morphology of the synapse. You don't get it in a couple of sections. And at the same time, I think most of these volume reconstruction technologies are not really at a stage yet where it can be applied to very large volumes, like a cortical column or the entire CA3 area. So in my opinion, it's at a stage where it can be applied effectively to small volumes. And this is one example where we can look at the proximal part of the CA3 region and look at the development of those synapses and ask, what did they look like? So this, so our approach, it's kind of outlined over here, is to dissect out, the animals are fixed, you dissect out the hippocampus. We're interested in looking at the development of synapses in this region. And so we take animals from birth until adulthood, and then zoom in on this part of the brain, and then use the serial block phase scanning EM method to look at, to reconstruct circuitry over some distance. And for those of you who are not familiar with it, the general idea is that you have this block of tissue which is taken from the CA3 region. It's placed inside the microscope. There's a microtome that cuts a surface that is then imaged by backscatter EM and gives you an image that kind of looks like this. And part of what has made it useful is a lot of work actually in Mark Ellisman's group in trying to increase the contrast. I'll show you a few examples in a minute that allows you to not only see axons and dendrite very clearly, but you can see the sites of synaptic connectivity. This is just a zoom in of this region showing a small region where this is the main apical dendritic trunk. And these are little pieces of the dendrite that are actually connected to this dendritic this dendritic segment. Now, this thing runs in an automated fashion overnight or several hours. And so you end up getting a stack of sections, about 400 or so sections in our typical runs, that are aligned. And so the next morning, you can go and collect the data, and then you can spend all your time analyzing it. This will also reveal in a minute kind of where the bottleneck of this technology is. For those of you who like solving problems, there's something that you can probably do to really help this thing out. Now, I want to quickly show you an example of what the raw images look like. So we're looking at a small region from CA3 And I just want you to note the elements to follow. So here you can see kind of the nucleus within the cell body. You see a bunch of areas that are kind of not very densely labeled inside. This is part of the cell body. These are parts of dendrites over here, over here, over here, over here, etc. And all the small circles over here are axons. These are axons coming from the dentate gyrus. So they move in a very tight fascicle. So actually, just in a single image, you get a sense of kind of the organization of this region. And then these axons will eventually make synapses onto these dendrites. We'd like to know something about what the synapses look like and how they develop. And so this movie will just, we're just kind of looking through the stack to show you what the raw images look like. So, you know, the main thing to note is that it's very easy to follow individual processes as you go through the depth of this thing. You know, the dendrites seem, you can follow them pretty naturally. And you can see in this little zone where there's lots and lots of little dendritic branches and spines coming out, in single sections, it would just be a big mess. But if you are able to follow through a few sections, you can kind of see how they emerge from the from the main dendritic tree. Excuse me? So I think for all details of how the tissue is processed, you should talk to Mark Ellisman. So I'll tell you about the reconstruction, but it is a key part of getting good images. Yes?
The simple
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know what the resolution is in pixel size. All I can tell you is that the smallest things we can distinguish are things that are around vesicles. So, those appear as little dots in most cases. In this, one of the nice things about this synapse again is that it has a very big bouton with lots and lots of vesicles, and so there's very little ambiguity in finding where the synapses are, and therefore you have some confidence, and you see a little. It's not like a little dot; you don't know what it is. So, what I want to emphasize is that this method is already at a state where it can generate tons and tons of data. So it doesn't take very long to do this, and but what takes a really long time is to then reconstruct what's going on. And I am no computational biologist, but whenever I see something like this, it seems like this is a problem that somebody should be able to solve so that the reconstruction can be done in an automated way, which has been kind of rate limiting. So the way we do it is that we have a team of undergraduates. who end up following a particular dendrite or a particular cell over a month, drawing all the connections, and then we have a graduate student who kind of was coordinating it, who would cross-check the information to make sure that we were getting the same kind of reconstructions, and it's slow, but it can be done. In fact, it's scalable in terms of the number of people we can put in parallel to go and look at these things. Now. And one of the other things that I've been thinking about but I have not implemented is it would be really good if there's some way in which we could, in fact, make this data available in some public space so that people could go and find parts of it and reconstruct it. So this is an example of a reconstruction now of a part of the apical dendrite of the CA3 region. And this is just to illustrate what the spines on this part of the dendrite look like. And I'll just show you very quickly as you go through the EM images kind of how you get a picture like this. But what you see at the end is you can see the main apical dendrite, and you see these very large spines. Each color here represents a different spine extending out of the dendrite, and it's this complex spine. It's called a thorny excrescence, or TE, as I'll refer to it. And as I mentioned to you, and I'll show you, is that each of these things can have multiple synaptic sites onto one of these spines. So each of these little bulges, in fact, forms a little postsynaptic spine. And in the next few slides, which I'll go through quickly, it just shows on the right-hand side what the section is that we're looking at. So this section one over here, so this is made from 400 sections. Section one over here is taken from this part, and within the field of view, you can see that this is kind of the tip of this little dendrite on the spine, which show up as little pieces over here in this section. But as you follow them and move towards the cell body, you'll start catching these other structures, and you can see the axons as you go through. And so if you just follow the kind of the pinkish blob, that's the main dendrite. And here you can see that these two things, again, these things, I think by most classical EM techniques would be very hard to connect or find. These two are a part of the same dendrite, you know, branch over here and a branch over here. And then they'll end up converging at some point. You might even see them. No, not cells. Each of these colors corresponds to a different spine. So it's everything is from one cell that is colored, and then each of the little if it's all in green over here, all of these correspond to a single protrusion off of the main dendrite. And so you'll see that they seem splintered, but then they'll they'll come together at the dendrite. Oh, over here, well, there's a gap, yeah. So this one is probably a little harder to explain. I know it's further out. So most of them tend to be very close, fairly close to the cell body, and they're clustered. The main reason is that, so that synapse is specialized to be able to drive the cell to threshold if a single axon fires the train of action potentials. So the DG to CA3 synapse is one that shows very little associativity. There are not multiple DG axons converging on a postsynaptic cell. So a single cell has to be able to fire train of action potentials, drive the postsynaptic cell to threshold. And the way it essentially does is it takes this, you know, the single axon and in effect turns it into multiple synapses onto the same cell, fairly close to the cell body. So that's one reason why they're clustered. They're fairly close to soma. You probably get decent depolarization. Every once in a while, there are a few that are further out. I don't know if that positioning means a lot. The undergrads do everything. Nothing is automatic. So every little, you know, there are little tools that are supposed to help with separating things, but in our hands, they're not so great, and so it was actually more reliable to do it by hand. So I think that this is kind of an actively evolving area. So I don't know whether the latest way of segmenting he has would have worked for these things. This is, you know, about a year old when we started doing this. Yeah, I know. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. All right. So I'm just gonna. So now I'm gonna show you a few images from the development of the synapse, and make a couple of observations that we can infer from the EM data. So P0 is the first age, and this is an age when there are not a lot of functional synapses. Very, very few, and. And this synapse develops in a way that seems to be somewhat different. So both its adult form and its development seem to be somewhat distinct from other synapses that have been studied. So if you look at the classical spines further out, and Stephen has done a lot of this work, there is a period when the dendrites are filled with lots of filipodia. And they're very dynamic, and pretty much, you know, the entire dendritic shaft is filled with these processes that come out. They precede, generally speaking, the appearance of spines. And there's some debate about exactly the relationship between filipodia and spines, but it's pretty clear that an early stage of synaptogenesis involves lots of filipodia. Most of these cells in the proximal regions that are looking at, this is the dendrite, these are postsynaptic structure, are not studded with filipodia in any way that resembles what the distal dendrite would look like. So in this case, you can see axons coming into contact with the dendrites. These are in different colors. The postsynaptic dendrite is shown over here. It looks fairly smooth. P7 is when we can first detect functional synapses. If you were to record from the hippocampus and say, when do you start seeing functional synapses, it's about P7. And this is what it looks like at P7. So the left-hand side shows what the proximal apical dendrite looks like. And you can see there's small emergences of protrusions from this dendrite. But what is striking is that at the same time, the axons show very clear signs of specialization in contact with the main dendritic shaft. So these are examples of axons coming from the dentate, and you can see in each case there is an expansion of the axons resembling a presynaptic bouton at the site of contact with the axon. And if you look in cross sections, you can see that these are also sites of clustering of synaptic vesicles. So the first sign that we see of synapse formation really appears as specializations on these axons as they're contacting the main apical shaft. Yeah. Oh, okay, yeah. So once you draw the contours by hand across the entire set, but then there's a program that allows you to connect the contours into an image, obviously. Everything is drawn by hand. Yeah. So I'm very tempted to leave behind some of these images of movies and for someone to find some clever person to go and figure out ways to make this fact. It's really what slows this thing down. Okay, so I'm going to show you a couple of movies because these lectures are a little bit longer than a standard seminar. And this is just to give you a sense. Of course, what you're getting out of it is not just a 2D projection, but you have the 3D information. So I'll just show you a couple of movies just to give you a sense of what the organization of the synapse looks like at a few different ages. So in this case, we're just going to rotate that image. It'll give you a sense of kind of the arrangement of the axons. Here shown, here's one yellow one. You can see the expansion of the axon over here, here, the bouton. And you'll see that the main dendrite show up in a minute. And one of the things that I want to point out as you see it is that the sites of closed apposition are actually very clear. And then they're color-coded here in slightly different shades of pink, for example, or purple. So when you see the axons in contact with dendrites, you can clearly see sites of very close adhesion, which would be at a synaptic distance, compared to other areas that are kind of close, but not quite as tightly. So as far as we can tell, we think that these initial adhesions probably represent what would be the equivalent of a recognition event between the axon and the if there was a section loss, you would not pick it up in something like this. Yeah, so in the next slide, you'll see all the spines. So at this point, the only things you see, which I'm not sure we can call, so there are these little protrusions shown over here in red. These are coming out of the dendrite, this little red thing. They don't quite look like classical filopodia, so I'm not sure whether it is. Stephen, would you call these filopodia? I'm just calling them protrusions because they don't quite look like the kind of filopodia you see in classical. Yeah. So they tend to look a little different. So I think, yeah. No, so just to be clear, so we have a stack of 400 sections, and every section they're drawing the outline of that thing in every section, right? So. Yeah. So okay. So practically, what they're doing, and I will not be able to tell you what the jump size is. There is you know, there's a little flat screen panel on which they're drawing it, and if there's some resolution of that big screen that they're doing it with, and I don't know what the smallest physical distance is that's being. Yeah. No. What he thinks he's drawing is a smooth, you know, kind of analog curve, if you will. But the way the information is being captured depends on, you know, some, you know, whatever pixel or sensitivity of the screen in term. But I don't know what that physical distance is. Even when things are very, very fine, that reconstructing, yeah, right. Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, I think at the scale that we are looking at, I mean, frankly, to be honest, I mean, I think the place where we're extracting information is at the scale of things like boutons versus axon links, and at those scales, these don't matter. And I would say that for the kind of conclusions we can draw, or you know, even pretend to draw. Very small changes in the measurement would not make a big difference. So there's a dramatic increase in the complexity of this structure between P7 and P14, and this shows a P14 reconstruction now. So on the left-hand side is the dendrite, where each of the colors represents a complex spine emerging from a common dendritic shaft. So you can get a sense of the density, but you can also see that these things now really look like complex spines coming out of the dendrite, which we did not have in the previous section. And then to be able to show the axons, I've turned all of these red, and then superimposed on them the axons that come into this region, where they now form these very large boutons. And this is a time when there's a lot of functional synaptic connectivity, and you can also begin to image kind of where the synapses are forming compared to the site of contact between the axon and the dendrite. And one thing that was interesting is that I showed you that the initial contact happens between the bouton and dendritic shaft often. The dendrites, the spines then kind of grow out of the dendritic shaft and essentially envelope these large boutons. And hopefully you'll get a sense of it. And most of the synapses form on the surface that's away from the shaft. So you have a dendrite, you have an axon sitting over here, and then the boutons kind of curve around, and pretty much the far end of the bouton is where many of the you can see the synaptic specializations. So this is important and would be relevant later on, because I think that the mechanism for target recognition or initial adhesion and the mechanism that regulates synapse formation are essentially two independent events. It's not like those initial adhesions turn into synapses. So I'm going to show you one of these things again in a rotational rendering, so that you can get a sense of how this sit. And yeah. You probably don't see these spines in a Christine Harris paper generally. No. So I mean, the vast majority of the synapses you probably see are probably CA3, CA1 synapses. It's a different synapse. It doesn't look like this. So what I want to point out over here is that, and this is a little hard to fully represent here, maybe there's a better way to show the different colors, is that each of these large boutons is in contact with a number of different spine heads that all belong to the same complex spine that share a neck. So although they're in this space, where you have all these presynaptic boutons right next to each other, and you have this the emergence of the postsynaptic structures. There is very little sharing or very little error in terms of where the connections get made. So single bouton will essentially have control over all of the spines that come out of one of these spine heads. And the only times there are errors, and this is something you see, not errors, some reaching out to other spines, is that some of these boutons have these little extensions. You can see there are several examples at this age, at P14. And so the bouton has these little arms that stick out, which you don't see so much in an adult. And those little arms will often contact a neighboring spine from another neck that is mainly dominated by a different presynaptic bouton. But then those largely go away. By the adult, they're all, it's like a one-to-one correspondence between the bouton and the... So maybe I'll try to point it out as this is moving around. So there's the main axon trunk coming in, and this is a good one maybe you can see. So this one has these little, there's like, and also the initial bouton is a little, in the adult they tend to get much, they don't have these little extensions like you see over here. They're more uniform in shape. You can see a huge green one over here that spreads across. So although potentially they could have been in contact with multiple spines from different necks, the specificity is really, really pretty precise.
Now, those things, back in the dark ages of dyad and protocols, we did look at those things, and those big boutons you see on the dental fibers and Masi fibers, those things have full
filipodia. Oh, yeah.
That's exactly what you're describing.
Yeah. Those are real filipodia. They're like axon, bouton filipodia, kind of.
They're axonal bouton.
Yeah. Those look like real regular filipodia.
Yeah.
That's consistent. Yeah. Is it a bona fide filipodia? You can call that one, right? Yeah. Yeah. So. They seem to be coordinated in that. So what you see is, so first of all, it is fairly in one zone where both the boutons and the postsynaptic spines develop. You have examples, and this would be an age, but between P7 and 14, where you have a postsynaptic spine grow out and form its multiple heads. And there's a period often where you can find that they're not all occupied. So you can see individual, structurally, morphologically, you can see like spine specializations that don't have a clear presynaptic bouton associated with it. Whereas by the time you go a week later, they're all occupied. So my sense is that there's some program that kind of induces the flowering of the spine, if you will. And it's probably not triggered by the bouton causing. Yeah, I should also clarify that. So we have not drawn every axon on this thing. So this could well be targeted by another axon. We've just shown a few. Yeah. Yeah. The major dendrite is still it's still growing. Yeah. Oh, in terms of the signals that control this, most of the growth, I should say, at this age, although the dendrite is growing, most of the growth or the obvious growth is happening further distally. So you see the distal branches growing and branching a lot more. In this region, things are not changing that much. There are not a lot of new dendritic branches and so on at this point. So the overall tree is growing, however. Okay. And this is an example of what it looks like in an adult. The thing that strikes you is that the whole thing seems neater. You know, you have each of these complex spines that emerges has postsynaptic spines that are of relatively uniform size, which I think you can just kind of see visually. And then there are essentially no errors in the boutons, connecting to a cluster of these spines on the postsynaptic side. So I probably have one rendering of this. This will just go around once to show you what the association looks like. And also at this age, the presynaptic boutons don't have the filopodia that Stephen was talking about. So you'll see the axons drawn onto this in a minute. No, multiple. So each of these little circles will generally have one active zone, but there are many of these little grapes on a little stick. So generally, just to give you a sense of the number, so from one neck there'll be a complex spine that has 30 active zones, between 20 and 30, but it's one big axon, right? So this one big bouton has 30 active zones, but each of those active zones is associated with one of these little spine heads. Yeah. All right. It's. I don't think we have ever seen it. So if it happens, it must happen exceedingly rarely. So they all contact. Each of the spine heads contacts only one bouton. Yeah. No, all of the spines have one neck. So from the dendrite, there's one neck that comes out, and then there are these little circles that stick out of it. Okay. So the next two slides kind of just summarize certain features of the presynaptic and postsynaptic differentiation that you can see from the reconstructions. The first sign of specialization, which appears as clustering of vesicles, you can see fairly early at P0. This is when it's in contact with the shaft of the dendrite. By P7, you can clearly see an expansion of the region that is in contact with the shaft. At P14, you have very large prominent boutons, and many of them have these bouton filopodia, as I showed you some examples. And by adulthood, most of these filopodia are gone. You have these very large boutons that are in contact that control each of the postsynaptic sites. And if you look at the postsynaptic side, you have very little tiny protrusions that are present early on. They don't quite look like the classic dendritic filopodia, and their role in synaptogenesis, I think, at least from these images, is a little unclear because they're not in contact with the bouton and so on. So they are protrusions, but it's not really clear whether they really develop into these things. But by P14, you see fairly complex bouton-like structures in contact with the presynaptic expansions. They are much more varied in structure at P14. This shows kind of the range of what their morphologies might look like. Although you can see the emergence of these little zones in some cases, but they're not all uniform and the numbers vary. And then by adulthood, you have these structures that are typical of the mossy fiber synapses, where you have very uniform little spine heads coming off of a single neck that'll form synaptic junctions. Okay. So, so we could tell that the axons contact the dendrites and make synapses between P7 and P14, and at least in the morphology, it appears that there is some recognition event between the axon and the dendrite. And we were interested in knowing what mediates that recognition, and one of the questions had to do with how much of it is just a reflection of the fact that the CA3 is in a privileged position compared to dentate, and how much of it is that the dentate axons can really tell that the CA3 is its correct target. So if you look at the macroscopic view of the hippocampus, the dentate axons are going to grow, and they will interact first with CA3 cells. And CA1 is further distal, although CA3 and CA1 cells look very similar. They're pyramidal cells, and they have similar histories. And so you can imagine that the axons grows in and just makes synapses with the first set of excitatory cells it contacts, and those are the synapses we see. And that the reason it does not contact CA1 is just because CA1 seems to be further out. Alternatively, it could be that there is a specific interaction between the dentate axons and the CA3 dendrite, some kind of a molecular recognition, so that it knows that's its target, and it just knows that CA1 is not the right target. It doesn't have to do with the fact that it's just further out. And in vivo, this is a little hard to sort out, so we decided to see whether or not we could reconstruct this problem in a smaller scale in culture, preserving the essential feature of target selection. So the question was that would a dentate neuron be able to select CA3 as its correct target over CA1 cells if these spatial biases were removed and independent of other patterning cues that might be present in the hippocampus? And so to do that, Megan Williams, who's a postdoc in the lab, developed this assay, which involves microcultures of hippocampal cells. So let me just tell you how this experiment is done. She starts out with a non-permissive substrate. She sprays polylysine and collagen onto them to create small islands over which we can grow cells. Then she plates astrocytes onto these islands so that after a week or so you have a nice bed of astrocyte on top of which you can grow neurons. And then she dissociates hippocampal neurons and plates them over these astrocyte beds so that then they can begin to extend axons and dendrites. And it is plated at a density so that each island generally has between 15 and 20 neurons. And if you get with that density, we should have all of the cell types represented in each island. And then we want to know whether or not single dentate cells in an environment like this can select the correct from the incorrect targets. So in order to do that, she also transfects the cells before she plates them, and then analyzes only islands where a single neuron is transfected. This would allow us to see the morphology of the cell. And then she uses a set of markers to determine the identity of all of the cells in culture, so that she would know that I have a transfected dentate cell and I have CA3, CA1 dentate cells in culture. And what it looks like at the end of the experiment is shown on the right. This is an example now of a 12-day culture stained with MAP2 on top, and you can see a small field of view where there are beautiful looking neurons. Now, if you just looked at the neurons, you would not be able to tell which neuron is which. But she was able to find a set of markers that can be used to uniquely determine what the cell types are. And the bottom panel shows the same field stained with these markers, combination of PROX1, CTYP2, and PY. The names don't really matter, but the colors matter, and they tell you that you can see that the dentate cell looks different from the CA1 cell, looks different from the CA3 cell. So now we have a way of going into culture and asking about this question of synaptic specificity. And the question is that this dentate cell, will it be able to tell that this is the correct target and this is not the correct target, given that now it has equal access to all of them? So now, in order to visualize the synaptic terminals of this neuron, the cultures are generally transfected with a synaptophysin GFP construct, which has been used widely in the literature, and that shows that the GFP staining gets targeted to presynaptic sites. Now, I'll just show you an example of what an experiment like this would look like. Here's an island of about 20 neurons. There's one cell transfected over here, and you can see other scattered cells in the field of view. Actually, the MAP2 staining shows all the cells. And then you can see little green puncta scattered throughout this island. And I think it's, you can clearly see association of these green puncta with certain postsynaptic cells. And it's clearer in this image. So now the dendrite cell body is way down there somewhere. The axon has grown in, and it has concentrated synaptophysin GFP staining at all of these sites near potential postsynaptic neurons. And if you just look at this field of view, you can see that many of the puncta are associated with these two cells, not so many with these two cells. Morphologically, they look a little different. But we wanted to know, using markers, whether or not the axons are really picking out their correct targets. And so when she quantified this, she found that indeed there was a strong preference of the dentate cells to make synapses onto the correct targets. So they'll make some mistakes. And this shows on the left-hand side, if you count the number of synaptophysin GFP puncta, these are all coming from single dentate cells. Let me just describe this slide and then I'll answer your question. You can see that there are significantly more onto the CA3 neurons compared to other dentate and CA1 cells, which show some level of background synaptic input. If you normalize it by dendritic length, so that you're not just biased based on the length of the dendrites of these cells, you can see that, again, there's a strong bias for the synapses to form on the correct target compared to the other cells. And this is not simply because we just have so many CA3 cells in culture that those are the cells they keep running into. So if you look at the distribution of cell types in culture, and remember, we just dissociated the hippocampus and plate them, it turns out that in a typical island, there are actually more dentate cells than CA3 or CA1 cells. There are about comparable numbers of CA3 and CA1 cells, but twice as many dentate cells in an island. But this is not reflected in the distribution of the inputs that we see onto CA3 cells. Yeah, David. So,
or another way, there's some region in culture that
developmental things tend to talk
more
about. Yeah, no, so I don't have the slide over here, so which we looked separately. So they actually cross with equal frequency with all the cell types. So if you look at, so if you just look at crossings, you cannot predict where the synapses will form. Because we thought there might be some fine scale repulsion going on, and maybe the, you know, some of the axons are being prevented from contacting dendrites. But if you were to just map it based on axon dendrite contact, you would get a distribution that does not show any preference. So for similar levels, numbers of crossings, you see a bias in where the synapses will form.
So don't they tend to sort of disseminate rather than cross a lot?
So, you know, in these islands, I don't have an image. It doesn't happen as much, and so I don't know if it's a property of the substrate or the overall density is somewhat low. In a mass culture, which is definitely higher density, we tend to see fissiculation both between axons and axon dendrites more than we see over here. It might also depend on, this is another thing, on the presynaptic axon population. So we have done similar experiments where we label the CA3 axons. And there are clear differences in the behavior of the dentate axon and the CA3 axon. Maybe at the end of it, I'll try it because it's not in this presentation. So the dentate axon, it extends out and then starts branching and then makes synaptic contacts within some of the branches. The CA3 axons grow a lot longer, and so then they go round and round and round in these micro islands, often fasciculating. The total length is much greater than the dentate axon, and so you can clearly see differences in axon behavior even in this very reduced system. And it kind of reflects what the cells tend to do, at least to some extent in vivo, in that the dentate axon typically makes many fewer synapses than a CA3 axon. And so it could be that there is some, you know, maybe CA3 cells have greater adhesivity between those axons because they form a different bundle. So, yeah. Yes. So when you look at the distribution of the synapses, I don't have the quantification of it. Similar to what you see in vivo, you see most of these dentate synapses forming in the proximal dendrites, and not in the distal dendrites. So there's another level of recognition, proximal versus distal, that is also preserved. No. So in the CA3 synapses, they seem much more promiscuous. So they at least they don't clearly follow a very, you know, the distal band. Although, you know, normally they occupy a pretty broad band of the dendrite, and so maybe if you look very closely right next to the cell body, we might see something. Yes, they're spontaneously active, but an important point to make is that that activity is not necessary for them to be able to select the target cells. So they're spontaneously active at about the right, you know, at beginning about six or seven days in culture. This is all looking at 12 days. So in the beginning, we actually thought that the spontaneous activity might have something important to do. And it might have something to do with the subset of the correct targets it's picking, which we don't know yet. But if you just look at selectivity between potential targets, that is not disrupted by either sodium channel blockade with something like TTX or synaptic transmission blockade with CNQX and APV. So they are spontaneous active, but yeah. Yeah, so I'll show you the function in the next slide. And so to look at the functional connectivity, Beth Davis, who's a student in the lab, has done a lot of paired recordings where she gives a single action potential to a presynaptic cell and records the evoked EPSC in the postsynaptic cell. And this is a very difficult experiment because at the end of that, she has to then fix the culture and use antibodies to determine what the pre and postsynaptic identities were, because initially they're blind. And when you do that, when you pull the electrode out half the time, you can't stain the cell very well. But you can get enough of them to see clear differences in responses depending on the identity of the cells. So these are examples, traces of DGDG, DGCA1, DGCA3 synapses. And this shows the quantification of that. And the evoke response on the CA3 cells is a lot larger than on either of those. Now, this is a combination of two measures, right? Which is, this is affected by the total number of synapses that are being made onto the cell, as well as the property of the individual synapse, right? So it's kind of a composite of what the mini size would be and the number of synapses. So based on anatomy, we think that at least part of it is because of numbers of synapses. And unfortunately, there's not a great way to determine which minis are coming from which cells to know whether that significantly contributes. Yeah. Yeah. These are all at, they're 12-day cultures. Yeah. Everything I show, unless I tell you, is 12 days in culture. Yeah. So we haven't done that, and it's a good question as to whether eventually it'll all become CA3 dominated and nothing in CA1, and we haven't done later recordings. One thing I should point out, so although these synapses show many features of the connectivity you would expect in vivo in terms of specificity, etc., there are certain features, at least by 12 days, they do not recapitulate. And one of the biggest features is this thing about paired pulse facilitation. So in the brain, these are highly facilitating synapses. You give two pulses, you get a very big response to the second one. In these cases, if you do a paired pulse experiment, you don't see the same degree of facilitation. My hunch is that that might be a later evolving property, and that if we were to wait long enough, we might be able to get that. But it might also depend a lot on the structure of the whole synapse, because in vivo I told you that there's a big bouton, multiple postsynaptic sites, and that geometry might really facilitate the facilitation. And we don't know whether we would get synapses of that kind over here, and so it might not get to that point.
If you look in culture over a long period of time, you just measure single antigen synapses, they don't have facilitation in their stage either. And by the time they're anymore, later we might start.
Yeah, so it could be that it will evolve over time, right? Now, which would be very interesting to know, because that's another difference where the mechanism is not very well understood as to what makes it facilitating or depressing. Yeah. Yeah. So in this case, the entire culture is sitting on a bed of glia, and the exact role they're playing is not clear. The reason we initially did some cultures without any glia, but that tends to lead to much more fasciculation than what you see over here. So if there's no other cells like sticking together, so then you end up getting these little cables, and it's harder to analyze. You can't tell what the postsynaptic targets are. So in the very least, the glia allow the axons and dendrites to spread out more. There's evidence from other labs that glia can produce signals that will promote synapse formation. So I would expect that they are maybe generally prosynaptogenic in some way. But whether at the local level, whether there's something special about the glia near the sites of DGCA3 synapses, we don't know. Yeah, so they're probably not critical, right? So we haven't we really haven't reconstructed a lot of the glia yet, and it would be very interesting to find that out. Because what drives this, you know, very peculiar morphology is not clear, and it could be that there's a population of glia in that band. That's important.
Well, the picture that we'll be seeing in the image is that those little very fine processes of the glia, the ones that get close to the synapses, are in almost every stage of life extremely dynamic. So, you know, if you're only fixation, the synapse may or may not have a glial process into it. But integrated over 10 minutes, it's effectively a duty cycle.
Yeah, so we have imaged these synapses in culture, and so one striking thing is that early on, you know, say between P7 and P12, or 7 and 12 days in vitro, when most of the synapses form, there's very high turnover rate. So it's not as though the synapse, so in that case, you're imaging the synaptophysin GFP puncta in contact with the postsynaptic site over a few hours, and you see a lot of these, you know, putative synapses form and go away. So it doesn't appear that once a synapse forms, it just stays there. And this is also true for cortical cultures. So there is a kind of a high turnover state to a low turnover state that you observe here and in other places. We've done a few experiments where we have tried to look at the earliest stages, like at about, you know, when the synapses first start forming at about 7 days, when they're in contact with correct and incorrect targets, to see, you know, is the behavior of these synapses somewhat different than these synapses? And the only difference is kind of a difference in half-life. So although they're both turning over, even in culture, the ones on the incorrect targets seem to be, there must be some kind of automatic fast turnover rate that you see in those. But when they're in contact with the correct targets, their turnover rate is slower. And it appears that what ends up happening is that gets amplified very quickly, so soon you have lots and lots of synapses on the correct ones, and then when it slows down, you are left with this kind of a... Yeah, so I think that at the very early, at the earliest time points, so, you know, my guess would be that you probably need to get some stability on the presynaptic side before this ramified postsynaptic thing really can capture the bouton and stay. It would be great if we had good ways of imaging, you know, something at that kind of resolution at the early stage. No, a part of it is just, you know, what you want to be able to do is you want to be able to see something at very high resolution in a dynamic way. So the block fits, of course, will just give you little snapshots, and maybe we could catch something. But I think that you know, being able to you know, image it live would really probably give you more information. Okay, all right, so. So we had some evidence that the dentate cells are able to identify CA3 as their appropriate target. We also found a second way of looking at the inputs onto a CA3 cell. So what I just showed you was looking at the problem from the dentate perspective, an axon picking between different targets, but you can also look at the postsynaptic CA3 neuron and ask how many inputs does it get from dentate versus other inputs. And for that, we were able to use this very nice synaptic marker called synaptoporin, which is expressed very highly in the terminals only of the dentate axons and not any of the other axons in the hippocampus. So you can see this, the mossy fiber bundle, very nicely labeled. And this marker, turns out, it also works in culture. So you can first verify this by going back to our culture, looking at dentate, CA3, and CA1 axon synapses, and asking whether or not the synaptoporin was associated with the dentate axons and not with the other axons. And the labeling on the right-hand side, these white puncta, are co-labeling, showing the synaptophysin co-localizations with synaptoporin. And the point is that if you look at that, you do see a strong association with the dentate axon terminals. So this marker does work and is useful as a way of identifying dentate axon terminals in synapses. So we're going to use this to kind of explore the molecules that might regulate synaptic input. So the question was, what is determining this close association between the dentate and CA3 cells? And we tried a number of different ways of trying to identify what the molecules would be, because we thought that there's a cell surface molecule that might mediate interaction between dentate and CA3. And in the end, what turned out to be effective was to kind of survey the presence of transmembrane proteins during the period of initial synapse formation at P7 and look for markers that are selectively expressed in dentate and CA3 and ask whether or not they have a role in synaptic specificity. And I won't tell you about all the ones that did not work, but the molecule that does seem to play an important role is a particular cadherin called cadherin 9. So this is an in situ hybridization for this gene called cadherin 9, and you can see that it's expressed very strongly in dentate and in CA3. It's not in CA1 and in other areas. It appears to mediate homophilic interaction, which is what you would need for this kind of synapse to form. So if you express cadherin 9 in a non-neuronal cell, 293 cells, and then you probe it with an ectodomain of cadherin 9, this FC cadherin 9 construct, you can see that in control 293 cells, there's no binding. So there's very little background binding of Cad9 to these cells. But if the cells express Cad9, then FC Cad9 will bind very nicely. And as in the case of other cadherins, there is this is calcium dependent. So if you chelate calcium, you no longer see binding. And this just shows that one of the downstream signaling component called beta-catenin is tightly associated with the junctions between cells that express cadherin 9. Now, what I should mention about cadherins is that this is one of a few families of proteins that we focused on because they have pretty high diversity. There are 22 odd cadherins in mammals, in rats and mice, and they're known for their differential expression pattern. And it's been periodically suggested that they might play an important role in connectivity, but it's been limited because for many of the cadherins, there aren't loss of function tools, and the experimental evidence has been largely based on one of the cadherins called N-cadherin, which is fairly broadly expressed in the nervous system and plays a general role in synapse formation. So whether or not specificity can be mediated by something like this was not known. So if you look at all the cadherin gene expression patterns, so this is one of few major families we looked at. Cad9 is the only one that is selectively expressed in dentate and CA3. Like the other cadherins have different expression patterns, but don't have, don't show expression in these two areas. So the question is Cad9 contributing to the connectivity between? Contributing to the connectivity between dentate and CA3. And so what we did is we did these experiments where in culture we did both culture in vivo and in vivo, down-regulate Cad9 by expressing a small hairpin shRNA that targets Cad9, and then we can ask whether or not that affects the formation of these synapses and the specificity. So I'll go through a couple of experiments quickly because I do want to get to but I think we started a few minutes late, David, right?
Yeah.
So we're good. Okay, all right. Okay. So in the first set of experiments, what we're looking at now in culture is the consequences of downregulating Cad9 on all synapses versus the dentate synapses. So here is an example of a control CA3 neuron in culture, and it's stained with both a pan-synaptic presynaptic marker, VGLUT1, and the DG synaptic marker, synaptoporin. And all of these things that look yellow over here are the dentate inputs onto the cell. And this is a neuron that is transfected with a Cad9 shRNA. And this just shows that if you, in general, you see in this image, there's kind of a loss of proximal dendrites, synapses. But the question is whether or not there's a loss of the dentate synapses selectively. Yeah, a co-localization of all three of these things. So the quantification on the right-hand side shows what we see. So we're looking at synapses, all synapses made onto CA1 cells and onto CA3 neurons. And then we're looking at the effect of expressing the shRNA. So if you look at all the synapses, so in these cultures, now remember, the CA3 cell is receiving lots of other CA3 input. In fact, there are many, many more inputs from other CA3 cells than there from dentate in any given CA1 cell, in any given CA3 cell. So if you look at all the synapses, you see a relatively small decrease in total synapse number. But this doesn't tell you which synapses are affected. And then you can separate this out between the dentate CA3 synapses and the non-dentate synapses onto CA3 cells. And so first of all, onto the CA1 cells, there's no effect of the shRNA under any conditions. So the CA1 cells, as you'd expect, because they don't express Cad9, are not affected. But if you look at the CA3 neurons, you can find that you see a decrease in the dentate input, but not in the non-dentate input. So the loss of Cad9 leads to a selective loss, decrease, in the inputs that are coming from dentate without affecting the inputs from other areas. No, so in this experiment, it's done using synaptoporin as a marker for the dentate axon. So in this, we're not transfecting a single cell. We're just staining all the synapses and then using the synaptoporin marker to look at the dentate synapses. And we're asking whether or not one class of synapses is selectively reduced. No. So the RNAi is in scattered neurons, and then we're analyzing only the CA3 neurons based on a marker for CA3. All right. Now, so we also did this experiment in vivo. So there are two experiments. Because we expect it to be a homophilic interaction, we should see a disruption of the synapse if we either disrupt it in the dentate or in CA3. So for the dentate experiment, so now the shRNA is put into a virus, and it's injected into the dentate, which is over here. It has a GFP gene in it as well that allows us to see the axons. So you can see the axons coming from the dentate. And you can see at higher magnification the axons. And you can ask whether or not the presynaptic bouton morphology is affected. So in a normal case, these boutons are huge. They just stand out. And you can see the dentate presynaptic boutons, as you can see over here, and it's blown up over here. And when you look at Cad9 shRNA virus-expressing axons, you see lots of axons. So there's no defect in the growth of axons into this region. But there is a major loss in both the number and the size of these presynaptic boutons. They're kind of hard to recognize because they don't stand out as much. But at higher mag, you can go and pick them out. You can see one over here. You can see one over here. And this shows the decrease in bouton size when you do find them. And in a separate quantification, if you don't have it, you see a big decrease in bouton number as well. So this would be consistent with the idea that you need Cad9 in the presynaptic axons in order to get proper presynaptic differentiation. And the sister experiment to this is to manipulate it in the postsynaptic cell. So in all these experiments, I should mention that the injections are done during the first week after birth into dentate, in this case into CA3, because we're in the postsynaptic cells. And then you wait for about a week. And then at the end of the week, when you look at the tissue section, it looks kind of like this. You have a bunch of labeled cells, but just the viral labeling with GFP is actually not of sufficient resolution for you to see the postsynaptic spines. So then we go and fill the cell, typically with Lucifer yellow or another fluorescent dye, so that reveals the dendritic tree of the cell that has been manipulated. And we can also do control cells. And then we can look at the morphology of the spines when you perturb Cad9. So now this is light level analysis right now. And you can see, again, here's the proximal dendrite. It's splitting right over here. You see a cluster of these TE dendrites. And this kind of shows you kind of in contrast to the level of resolution I could see with EM at the light level, they look kind of like fuzzy blobs. But you can, based on location and morphology, you can tell that those are the right population of synapses. And then if you block Cad9, you get a dramatic disruption of the structure of these dendritic filopodia. So you don't get this small, well-differentiated TEs. Instead, you get lots of these protrusions that extend off of the main dendrite and that are very, very polymorphic and extend out of the dendrite. Now, what's interesting about this is that, so it tells you that you need Cad9 in the postsynaptic cell to get proper spine differentiation, but you'll recall that during normal development, it never went through this phase. So it is not really a case of arrested development of the postsynaptic spines, but rather in the absence of this adhesion molecule, it appears that those protrusions that extend continue to extend out without being able to form differentiated postsynaptic structures. And unfortunately, the last experiment for which I don't have a slide with me here is that we can ask that if you affect the postsynaptic Cad9, do you affect the differentiation of the presynaptic boutons? Because you might expect that if the postsynaptic cell is providing a signal for presynaptic bouton differentiation, you'd see a defect. And indeed, that turns out to be the case. So in these cells, if we reconstruct the presynaptic boutons, they fail to grow into those large boutons that we normally see. Yeah. Yeah, so like what happens over here? So I think that, you know, what we see, what normally happens, you know, the protrusion tends to kind of wrap around the presynaptic bouton. That's the normal behavior. In this case, the presynaptic bouton size is decreasing, the axon is going, but they're not forming proper boutons. I think it must, the way I interpret it is that there are these extensions from the dendrite that normally, by virtue of an adhesion with the bouton, are constrained to stay close to the cell and then form the multi-headed structure. But in the absence of a bouton, they're unconstrained, and this kind of reflects what that unconstrained behavior would be. Yeah, I don't know. We haven't grown those single CA3 cells. What ends up happening, I don't know, it's a good question to see whether, at least in the proximal regions, because there'll be a lot of CA3 synapses that are typical, and you'd see this autoptic synapses that'll be fairly normal in behavior. But whether in addition, there is something going on in the proximal dendrite, I don't know. Yeah? Yeah, so we haven't done that, but I think that would be very interesting to do, to find out whether you need this cadherin signaling to maintain the morphology of the cells in this state. Yeah, this is typically either at P5, and then we're looking at P14 or P21. So, yeah. 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 So there are two. It depends a little bit on the experiment. So in vivo, the DG axon emerges in a direction opposite to the DG dendrite. So the axon is actually never in contact with the dendrite, and it goes off towards CA3. In culture, however, it would have access to the DG dendrites, and so. You know, why it still picks the CA3 over DG, I'm not entirely sure. So obviously there are some, you know, synapses that do form between DG and DG. Maybe they are being mediated by this thing. The other possibility is that there is also something else that's a negative signal. So, I mean, in many of the analyses and when you look at the behavior of the axons, you get the sense, but we haven't proven it, is that there are things that prevent formation of synapses onto inappropriate targets. And so the DG dendrite might have additional signals that I'm not recognizing that might prevent it from forming. Yeah. Yes. Can you induce synapse formation? Yeah, so that's actually another another piece of evidence that suggests that it's there probably is something negative in CA1 as well. So what you do get is you don't get a clean, full, rescue phenotype. In other words, if you express it in CA1 cells, you get some increase in the number of synapses onto CA1 compared to what you would normally get, but you do not bring it up to the same level as you normally see with CA3 cells. Right? So if you just express CAD9 in CA1 in culture, you can increase the number of synapses you're forming, and maybe you're biasing the adhesivity a little bit. But although the expression of CAD9 is pretty high, you cannot bring it up to the same level as the number of synapses you see on CA3. So I think there's something else that's restricting synapses onto CA1. In vivo, we haven't done that experiment, but part of the problem is, so in vivo there's also a guidance aspect, which you can see the MOSI fiber axon tract developing pretty normally going up to the CA1, CA3 border. They don't really grow into CA1 very far in vivo. So even if you were to overexpress CAD9, maybe in the border areas you might be able to see if something happens, but we haven't looked at that in vivo yet. Okay. All right. So So based on these observations, we believe that at least with regard to the differentiation of this synapse, a CAD9-CAD9 interaction seems to be quite important. And one point that I want to emphasize is that embedded in the experiments I showed you, actually, there are two separate questions that are being addressed, one having to do with recognition, which is the ability of the dentate cell to tell that CA3 is the correct target, which seems to depend on CAD9. And the second is morphological differentiation, which is that having made a contact, whether or not you get the full differentiation of a structural synapse. And that also depends on CAD9, because when you do see the boutons or do you see the some sense of connectivity, they do not fully differentiate. So it would appear that these two things about structural differentiation and target recognition in this case are coupled. So in the last maybe 10 minutes or so, I want to touch upon one last part that has to do with synapse differentiation, and kind of has to do with the next step in how the synapses mature. So a lot of the stuff I've talked about so far has to do with kind of identifying the correct target and the molecules that might allow recognition to happen, and evidence that can happen independent of activity. But what you get at that point is not a functional synapse. And so we've been interested in trying to identify the signals that induce functional synaptic differentiation. And we've been looking at things that could mediate both pre- and postsynaptic specializations. And so I'm going to tell you a little bit about a class of molecules that appears to play an important role in this process, which are of a large family of proteins called leucine-rich repeat proteins. And these are large transmembrane proteins. They're single-pass transmembrane proteins that are characterized by a large extracellular domain that has multiple leucine-rich repeats. And these repeats end up forming a structure that looks like this. It's kind of a crescent, and depending on the number of repeats and the exact sequence, this can have a different curvature. And that is believed to form a ligand-binding pocket. And this family of proteins caught our attention because it was expressed highly during the period of synapse formation. It's differentially expressed in different cell types, and it's a pretty large family of proteins. So there are 130 genes in the mouse that encode for cell surface LRR proteins, and out of those, about 60 are expressed in the brain. I'll show you an example of one class of them later on. And we've kind of focused on one of these families to see whether or not they play a role in synapse formation. So the particular family of leucine-rich repeat proteins that we've been studying is called LRR. The family is called LRTM, leucine-rich repeat transmembrane proteins, and LRTM2 is the one that I'll tell you something about in terms of its role in synapse formation. So before I get into these data, I should just kind of maybe briefly update you kind of on the status of synaptogenic molecules in the brain. So in the last decade or so, I'd say that a few molecules have been identified that have the ability to induce presynaptic differentiation in the CNS. And But given the diversity of cell types and synaptic types, it appears, or it is likely, that there might be many more of these proteins that might mediate synaptic connections between different classes of cells. And part of the goal here is to try to identify those components. And so what we're looking for here are looking for molecules that are going to be present at synaptic sites that will induce presynaptic differentiation and perhaps recruitment of postsynaptic components. So LRTM2, as I'll show you, fulfills both of those requirements. So to begin to ask whether or not they might play a role in synapse formation, we tagged LRTM2 with a MYC epitope, transfected hippocampal neurons, and asked where they get trafficked. And we can examine excitatory or inhibitory neurons by using specific markers like PSC95 or Jeffrin. And this shows that if you look at colocalization, there's nice colocalization of LRTM2 onto these spines, which are also PSC95 positive, but they're not present at inhibitory synapses. So they seem to be selectively targeted to excitatory synapses. So to ask whether or not this postsynaptic protein has the ability to induce presynaptic differentiation, we used an assay that was developed by Peter Scheifele and his colleagues, where you can express a gene of interest in a non-neuronal cell, 293 cells, and ask if it can induce a synapse onto an axon that is growing over the non-neuronal cell. And pretty remarkably in that assay, if you have a synaptogenic protein, the axon will make a synapse onto a cell that it normally would never, that's not a neuron. So this shows that in this kind of an assay, LRTM2 is a very strong inducer of presynaptic differentiation. So this is a control case, 293 cell expressing GFP, axons growing all around it, terminals labeled with synapsin, and you see almost nothing on top of the green cell. However, if you take this green cell and express LRTM2 on it, now you see a big cluster of synapses, presynaptic terminals forming onto that cell. So this molecule has the ability to induce presynaptic differentiation. And you can compare the ability, the synaptogenic activity, with a large number of other proteins, other LRTM family members, as well as neuroligin, which is the best characterized of the synaptogenic molecules. And you can see that it is, you know, comparably effective in inducing synapses as neuroligin. And of the other LRTM members, LRTM4 it can also induce synapses, but not as well as LRTM2. So we knew that we had a protein that was present at synapses that could induce presynaptic differentiation. And we wanted to know whether or not in gain and loss of function experiments in neurons, it could affect synapse number. So first, if you take hippocampal neurons and you overexpress LRTM proteins, and then look at synapses by colocalization of a postsynaptic marker like PSC95 and V-glute, you can find on this dendritic segment, under control conditions, there are a certain number of synapses that form. But overexpression of LRTM2 leads to a large increase in the number of excitatory synapses that form on this dendrite. It's pretty striking, and it's quantified over here. So you get about a doubling of the number of synapses with LRTM2, and you get some small increase with LRTM4. So this also then allows you to ask which part of this molecule is important for inducing synapses. You could imagine either the extracellular domain is directly interacting with something on the axon to induce synapses, or it could be that the intracellular domain is recruiting various other components that are then involved in inducing the synapses in some way. And when you do that, yeah? It's a transmembrane protein. It looks like this. If this is the membrane, it's on the surface, right? And so this shows that if you, these are again segments of dendrites looking at total number of synapses, that just the extracellular domain of the protein is enough to induce synapses. So if you just express this form, you get an increase in synapse numbers. You can get rid of this part. However, if you just express the intracellular domain, you don't have any effect. So this domain is not necessary and not sufficient to recruit components that might induce synapses. You need this outside part. So then we imagine that this extracellular domain is interacting with something on the presynaptic axon to induce synapses. We wanted to know whether or not it was required for synapse formation, and we have done this in a couple of different ways. Again, taking advantage of a short hairpin shRNA construct that targets LRTM2. This shows the efficacy of the construct. So we can express shLRTM2 that will downregulate LRTM2 very effectively. And here's a rescue construct, which is human LRTM2, which is not targeted by the rat LRTM2 shRNA, and we can use this to rescue any defects that we see. And when we put this construct in culture, what we see is a decrease. This shows the image, and this shows the quantification. We see about a 40% decrease in the number of excitatory synapses that form onto hippocampal neurons. And we only see this effect on the excitatory synapses and not on inhibitory synapses. So it seems to be selectively involved in excitatory synapse formation. So we also wanted to know whether or not this gene is involved in synapse formation in vivo. And this has been one of the challenges with Neuraligin, where in vitro it has many of the features that I showed you over here. But in a series of experiments, loss of Neuraligin in vivo has not led to a loss of synapse number or synapse function. And that has led to some controversy about discussion about what its real role in synaptogenesis is. So to begin to get at that, we cloned this shRNA into a lentiviral vector, which we then injected into the dentate and then looked at the synaptic inputs onto those cells. So the way the experiment is done is you inject the virus into the dentate during the first postnatal week. You record at P14. And this is a zoom in of the dentate gyrus. You can see a few infected cells and lots of uninfected cells. And it takes advantage of the fact that nearby cells in the dentate have very similar synaptic responses. So we record from two cells. You can see the outline of one electrode over here and an outline of the second electrode over here. And then you can stimulate the axons that are running over here, which is the input from entorhinal cortex, the perforin path input. And normally, neighboring cells or a control GFP cell will have very similar responses to a nearby uninfected cell. And the control case is shown over here. So if you plot the relative EPSC in the infected cell versus control cell, in control conditions or GFP transfected, that lies along the unity line. However, if you record from LRTM shRNA infected cells and control cells, you see a big decrease in the responses onto the infected cells compared to the control cells, as shown over here. And the example traces are shown on the right over here. You can see the GFP response is very similar to uninfected cells, but the LRTM shRNA gives you a significantly reduced response. It does not lead to a defect in presynaptic release probability, at least as measured in paired pulse ratios. So it appears that this postsynaptic protein LRTM2 is involved both in regulating the number of synapses and in the function of synapses in vivo. So in the last few minutes, I'm going to talk a little bit about how we think it mediates this effect. So what I've told you so far is that there's a protein called LRTM2 on the postsynaptic spine. What I didn't show you is that it can interact with this scaffolding protein called PSD95. Yeah? So, I don't know whether there is a fair bit of scatter, and I don't know if it's related to kind of when we do the experiment or just kind of, so this nearest neighbor thing showing very similar responses has been most extensively used in CA3, CA1 synapse, with this large bundle of axons, lots of cells, lots of synapses onto those cells. In this case, it could be that the response is generated by fewer numbers of total synapses, and therefore you end up getting bigger variability. It's true that that's the case, but I don't know what the cause of that variability is. So we wanted to know how it mediates presynaptic differentiation. So what's the interactor over here, and how it might recruit postsynaptic components. So what I didn't show you is that if you get rid of LRTM2, you also get a big decrease in the amount, in the number of AMPA and NMDA receptors. So one thing that I'm not going to show you is that the extracellular domain of the receptor can directly interact with AMPA receptors, and that's one mechanism by which it might recruit postsynaptic components. But I will show you a little bit about this interaction with the presynaptic side, which is not known. So what we did is, so we wanted to find what this binding partner was. And so what we decided to do was to see whether or not we could fish it out using this extracellular domain. So we made a protein that just had the extracellular domain of LRTM2. We coupled it with beads and made a column out of that. And then we isolated synaptosomes from P7 hippocampus, when the synapses are first beginning to form. And then kind of by mild detergent extraction, tried to get all the synapses out on either side. And then we ran those proteins over the column to see if we could find this binding partner. And the idea was then we would find the binding partners and whatever bound, and then use mass spec analysis to try to find what the receptor was. And when we did it, it wasn't really clear if it would work, because most of the mass spec dependent identification of components is components like this, which is that you have a cis complex and you pull down the whole complex and you ask what is associated with your protein of interest. But in this case, whether you could create a trans complex with enough specificity and find it was not clear. But it turned out to work really well. So this is a summary of the experiment showing the peptide counts for various binding partners that came out. And I think what you can see, without being a mass spec specialist, is that a large number of the things that bind to LRTM2 encode norexin proteins. You can see norexin 1, 2, 3. And it was very apparent that the dominant partner that we were pulling down is a protein called norexins. So this is very interesting, because norexins are a major presynaptic protein that are best known for its interaction with neuroligin, which is the other synaptogenic protein that I had told you about. But we did not suspect that this might be a binding partner, because LRTM2 and neuroligin look nothing like each other. So in primary structure and whatever is known about the structure, they are very, very different looking proteins. So this says that, and I'm going to show a couple of experiments showing that norexin is in fact the receptor for LRTM2, that norexins have the ability to bind to very, very different kinds of synaptic partners. And this will, I think, become important in terms of how we think about the problem. So we demonstrated using purified proteins that purified LRTM2 could indeed bind to norexin with fairly high affinity. And we looked at the binding of LRTM2 with all of the norexins. So there are three norexin genes, norexin 1, 2, and 3. The major forms are called alpha and beta. And you can see norexin 1 beta is a protein that binds best to LRTM2, although there's some binding to norexin 1 alpha as well. And within this is for people who care about structure, there's one particular region of it, this last LNS6 domain of norexin that seems to be very important in terms of binding specificity, because if you switch that domain out and take it from another norexin, you significantly reduce the amount of binding. So we know something about the specific norexins that LRTM2 interacts with, and that interacts with fairly high affinity. So what we know based on those experiments is that LRTM2 is in a position to interact with presynaptic norexins. We have experiments that I didn't get to show that if you downregulate norexin on the presynaptic axon, then LRTM2 is unable to induce presynaptic differentiation, and it can interact with postsynaptic AMPA receptors to induce synapse differentiation. So I think what is interesting about this interaction is that the LRTM family is a pretty large family. As I told you, there are about 60 genes that are expressed in the brain. And for most of them, the binding partners are not known. And we're trying to find out if they also bind norexins. Norexins are very interesting because these genes, although they're three genes, they're highly alternatively spliced. This was discovered by Tom Sudhoff and his colleagues now at Stanford. And I should also mention at the same time that we discovered this, their lab found this as well, and they were published together, that norexins have a great deal of diversity due to alternative splicing. And what that splicing means is not really clear. It's been hypothesized that it might be involved in connectional specificity. And what we're looking into now is this idea is that this diversity of norexins is what allows it to bind to very different kinds of ligands, so that it can bind to neuroligand, it can bind to LRTM2 that have nothing to do with each other. And it is in the splice form specificity that that would lead to this diversity in binding partners. And similarly, perhaps, the different LRR proteins, which belong to a superfamily, but also vary quite a bit in their primary structure, might allow you to bind to very specific neuroxin isoforms. And in this way, you might have kind of a neuroxin LRTM code that might mediate synaptic specificity. The other thing that I want to point out is that when you look at neuroxins, and now this has been studied for a while, it's clear that the interactions that they mediate might serve different functions at synapses. So on the left-hand side is kind of the initial neuroxin neuroligand complex, where it's known that beta neuroxin binds with neuroligand with high affinity. But there's also very good evidence that this interaction is mainly involved in the formation and recruitment of NMDA receptors in a very early stage in synapse formation. So you might know that in most CNS synapses, there's an early stage when the synapses have only NMDA receptors, and that might be mediated by a complex like this. For LRTM2, it interacts with both with beta and alpha neuroxins, and it interacts with AMPA receptors. So this might represent also a slightly later stage in synapse differentiation as the synapse is going from an NMDA only to an NMDA plus AMPA state. And there's a recent interaction with beta neuroxin that was described from Machina's group and another group in Japan, which is an interaction of neuroxins with a glutamate receptor, GluR-delta-2, that is only present in the cerebellum, that is mediated by this intermediate called cerebellin. So it forms a tripartite complex between neuroxin, cerebellin, and GluR-2. So neuroxins can form very different kinds of complexes with different postsynaptic partners, and they might be involved in different formation of different features of a synapse. And I just want to close with this in situ image of the expression pattern of the LRTM genes to kind of just tell you kind of where we see this going and where we think these proteins might be important. So this is really what initially got us interested in looking at the function of the LRTM genes. So this is in situs for LRTM1 through 4. And if you just look at the cortex, for example, in these cases, what is striking is how specific their differential expression pattern is. So LRTM1, for example, is expressed mainly in the superficial layers. You can see high expression in layer 2, maybe leaching out into layer 4 a little bit. LRTM2 is expressed very highly in layer 6 in deep cortical layers, very little in superficial cortical layers. On the right-hand side, you see LRTM3. Again, this expression is somewhat broader. It probably spans all of the cortical layers, but again, high-level expression in the superficial areas. If you compare 3 and 4, the cortical expression is not that different, but if you come back to the hippocampus, you see a big difference where there's very selective expression in the dentate for 4, not so much for 3. And so this suggests that these LRTM proteins might play a role in lamina-specific connectivity. And so one of the things that we're examining now is to go into the cortex and ask whether specific patterns of inputs are being regulated by different LRTM genes. And we're hoping to be able to use this to manipulate specific classes of inputs onto a neuron to begin to ask about the function of those inputs on the role of those inputs onto the function of the postsynaptic cells. So for example, if you look at layer 2, 3, you can see that there's LRTM1, 3, and some 4 expression. What we don't know is whether all three of these genes play the same role or whether they're regulating different classes of inputs. So one specific thing we're interested in knowing is whether, let's say, that layer 2, 3 neurons receive significant input from other layer 2, 3 cells and from layer 4 cells. And we have no idea what regulates those patterns of connectivity. So what we are doing is eliminating one of these genes and then asking whether a specific class of inputs onto the postsynaptic cell is affected. And if it is, then we would be in a position to use that as a perturbation to ask about the role of different inputs onto the postsynaptic cells. And I think I've summarized most of these things in words, so I'll just close by acknowledging the people who did most of the work I discussed today. The work with the in vivo reconstruction work was mainly done by Scott Wilkie, along with a group of undergraduates, and in collaboration with Mark Ellisman's lab. The work on the microislands was done by Megan Williams, who's a postdoc in the lab, and who discovered cadherin-9 as a mediator of dentate CA3 synapses. And And the LRTM work was done mainly by Joris de Witt, who's over here, as well as the identification of Nurexin as their binding partner. And I'll stop here. So there, the expression pattern is maintained and preserved. We don't know in terms of synaptic localization, because for most of them we don't have good antibodies yet. But as far as my guess would be that they continue to be expressed in the adult, and maybe they're needed to maintain the synapse as well. So several of them do interact with other neurexins, but some of them interact with non-neurexins. So the so this general approach of purifying synaptic proteins and finding the partners has turned out to be pretty productive, and so the specificity is pretty tight, but within the LRR family, they don't just interact with neurexins. So there are certain leucine rich repeat proteins that seem to bind other other partners.
And matrix,
exactly. Yeah. So there is. Yeah. It's something like this. In other words, there's a set of neurexins that interacts with a set of set of LRR proteins. There are other LRR proteins that interact with non-neurexins, and set of neurexins that interact with non-LRRs. Yeah. I mean, you could certainly at least bias connectivity. I would imagine. I think that one of the things that we've been, I think you could probably manipulate connectivity or form specific kinds of connections by expressing them in specific places. And one little interesting tidbit that I'll share is that we've been also looking at mutations in these genes and what they do, and the human literature is useful here. So you can ask, are there mutations in neurexins, LRR proteins, what do they do? And so it turns out that for a number of psychiatric disorders where there are not single gene causes, that neurexins actually are highly represented in terms of genes that are either mutated or have a copy number variation. So a lot of the human mutations happen in the form of not that the gene is altered slightly, but you have an extra copy or one copy less of a gene. And so there is this association of neurexin with autism, schizophrenia, a few different disorders. It's not so clear as to whether there's some kind of isoform specificity. And then very recently, we found the first association of LRTM2 mutants in the human population or in individuals, and that had to do with bipolar disease. And so these are all diseases that are not really well understood. People don't really know what happens in schizophrenia or bipolar disease and so on. But I think it's interesting that the genetic causes, when they can be mapped, seem to lie within this kind of a complex, and it might be that a very specific perturbation of one class of these inputs, with one particular neurexin or one LRR, could lead to some alteration in the way the circuit functions. That then is manifested in something that's like a complex psychiatric trait. Can you rescue one with another? We haven't done that in a systematic way. All we know is that when you downregulate different isoforms, you have differential effects in terms of the amount of decrease in the presynaptic input that you see. But whether you can rescue it by just overexpressing another one, I don't know. My guess would be that in the case in vivo, that would probably be hard, because just based on the ligand receptor interactions that we know, some of them at least interact with different kinds of receptors, and therefore it might induce differentiation of a different class of axons. And so you would get some kind of presynaptic differentiation. I'm sure that if you take LRTM knockdown and overexpress LRTM4 or 3, you'll still get induced presynaptic differentiation. But I would imagine you'd induce presynaptic differentiation in a different class of axons. So you can increase synapse number, but it probably will not work right, because it will have the wrong specificity.
Okay.